It's time once again for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. We're going to start our program this time with an article from Psychology Today. This article is entitled, Eight Dimensions of Disability. These key characteristics shape the experiences of people with disabilities. By Catherine R. Bogart, Ph.D. Key points. Some disabilities are more readily observable or more closely aligned with common stereotypes of disability. A disability's characteristics intersect with social barriers to shape a person's experience. Similar disabilities can have different dimensions, resulting in vastly different outcomes. While there are countless conditions that can result in disability, understanding just a few key characteristics can tell us a lot about how people might experience disability and how others will react to them. Below are eight cross-cutting dimensions of disability, described in a new chapter of the Handbook of Prejudice, Stereotyping, and Discrimination. Number 1. Disability Type. Categorized by the major functions affected, disability types include mobility, communication, chronic health, sensory, mental health disabilities, and many more. Some types are more commonly associated with our stereotype of what a disability is, such as mobility, sensory, and intellectual disabilities. For example, the symbol on disabled parking spots and bathrooms depicts a wheelchair user. The public may less readily recognize other disabilities. These include invisible disabilities, chronic health conditions, rare disorders, and mental health conditions. People with non-stereotypical disabilities may receive less support and more invalidation. They also may be less inclined to identify as disabled themselves. Number 2. Time of onset. Disability is perhaps the only minority group one can be born into or one can join at any point in life. Research indicates that individuals with congenital disabilities or who acquire them in early childhood may have an adaptive advantage. These individuals go through their initial development with their disability, learning to navigate the social and physical world alongside their disability. In contrast, those who acquire disabilities often face the challenge of relearning how to function. They may experience grief over the change in their abilities, identity, and how others perceive them. Evidence shows that those with congenital or early onset disabilities tend to have a stronger disability self-concept, which includes disability identity and self-efficacy, which is, in turn, associated with higher life satisfaction. Number 3. Observability. The degree to which a disability is noticeable shapes the kind of ableism individuals may encounter. I prefer to use the term observable instead of visible to avoid an ableist focus on one sensory domain and also to acknowledge that some disabilities may be observed through channels other than sight, e.g. a speech disorder. The majority of disabilities are non-observable, including chronic health and mental health conditions. While such disabilities allow individuals to pass as non-disabled and potentially avoid overt ableism, people with non-observable disabilities may face disbelief from others, including healthcare professionals, due to the absence of visible signs. On the other hand, observable disabilities such as amputated limbs, facial differences, or the use of assistive devices can attract stares, questions, and more blatant forms of ableism. Thus, ableism impacts both those with invisible and visible disabilities, though in different ways, subtle as opposed to overt. Number 4. Course. The course of a disability describes how it evolves over time. Disabilities can be temporary, like a broken bone, or chronic, lasting more than 6 months. Chronic disabilities may become more severe over time, progressive, be life-limiting, terminal, relapse and remit, episodic, or remain stable. Stable conditions, such as an amputated limb, are unlikely to change, making adaptation more straightforward. In contrast, progressive, terminal, and episodic conditions involve uncertainty about the future and require constant adjustment to fluctuating symptoms. Episodic conditions characterized by unpredictable flare-ups and remissions can make it challenging for others to understand the fluctuating nature of the disability. Individuals with such conditions may be perceived as unreliable, facing accusations of exaggerating their symptoms or faking their disability. Number 5. Prevalence. Whether a condition is common or rare interacts with social and structural factors to shape the experience of disability. In the United States, a disorder is considered rare if it affects fewer than 200,000 people. There are over 10,000 different rare disorders. Collectively, rare disorders affect approximately 1 in 10 Americans, making the experience of having a rare disorder quite common. Examples of rare disorders include narcolepsy, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, spinocerebellar ataxia, and blood cancers. Many healthcare providers lack adequate information about rare disorders, leading to an average diagnostic delay of 7 to 9 years. This results in long diagnostic odysseys filled with uncertainty and misdiagnosis. People with rare disorders may struggle to find support groups or connect with others who share their condition. When seeking support from family, friends, and healthcare providers, they often face misunderstanding or disbelief about their symptoms. These factors contribute to a lower health-related quality of life for people with rare disorders. They experience higher levels of anxiety and depression compared to the general population and those with more prevalent disorders. Number 6. Functional impairment. Referring to limitations in an individual's ability to perform daily activities or participate in society, functional impairment is strongly influenced by physical and social barriers. For example, whether a wheelchair user lives in an accessible community plays a large part in whether they experience functional limitations. Number 7. Fatigue. Conditions involving fatigue, such as myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS, have been historically contested and difficult to treat due to their invisible nature. A hallmark of ME/CFS is post-exertional malaise, where symptoms worsen after exertion and do not improve with rest. The lack of objective biomarkers and the reliance on self-reported experiences can create barriers to accessing appropriate health care and support. Number 8. Pain. A particularly challenging dimension, pain is a complex and often invisible experience. Individuals may struggle to have their pain taken seriously and may be mislabeled as drug seekers, leading to inadequate pain management. Chronic pain can significantly impact mental health, daily functioning, and overall well-being. To illustrate these dimensions, imagine two adults, Anna and Amir, each with a mobility disability. Anna was diagnosed with cerebral palsy at birth, and her condition is expected to be relatively stable over time. Thanks to a supportive family and access to good health care, Anna learned how to use a manual wheelchair at a young age. Her physical therapist helped her family adapt their home to be accessible. Anna has been part of a cerebral palsy organization in her state since she was a child, which has helped her develop a positive disability identity. One of Anna's biggest challenges is landing a full-time job. She often gets invited to interviews, but when employers see her wheelchair, they seem to patronize her and question her abilities. Amir began showing symptoms of muscle weakness as an adult. After years of doctor's appointments, tests, and ineffective treatments, he was finally diagnosed with Kennedy disease, a rare disorder resulting in progressive weakness. Amir feels like he has lost his identity and his former life. He needs to move to a different home or modify the one he has to be accessible. But it is hard to predict what his accessibility needs will be as his disease progresses. His symptoms wax and wane, especially as he tries new experimental treatments. Sometimes he can walk, other times he uses a manual wheelchair. The fluctuating nature of his disability means he needs a flexible work schedule and the ability to work from home sometimes. But his employer is unfamiliar with Kennedy disease and has refused these accommodations. While Anna and Amir both have mobility disabilities, they vary in the dimension of time of onset, observability, course, and prevalence. These examples highlight how social factors intersect with dimensions of disability, shaping individuals' experiences. This next article comes from Street Insider. It's entitled, Prevent Blindness Declares 5th Annual Thyroid Eye Disease Awareness Week as November 18 through 24, 2024. Prevent Blindness provides free educational material on thyroid eye disease, including a new patient-featured episode of the Focus on Eye Health Expert series, fact sheets, social media graphics, and dedicated web pages. Chicago. Prevent Blindness, the nation's leading nonprofit eye health and safety organization, has declared November 18 through 24, 2024, as its 5th annual Thyroid Eye Disease, TED, Awareness Week. TED, also known as Graves' Eye Disease or Graves' Ophthalmopathy, is an autoimmune disease in which the immune system causes inflammation and swelling and stimulates the production of muscle tissue and fat behind the eye. This year's TED Awareness Week is supported by Amgen, Immunovant Incorporated, Tourmaline Bio Incorporated, and Viridian Therapeutics. Symptoms of TED include bulging eyes, proptosis, dry, gritty, and irritated eyes, red eyes, puffy eyelids, sensitivity to light, watery eyes. In more advanced cases of TED, patients may also experience trouble moving eyes and fully closing eyelids, corneal ulcers caused by an inability to completely close eyelids, colors that appear to be dull or not as bright, blurred or loss of vision due to optic nerve compression or corneal damage. A recent study found that patients with TED are more likely to develop depression and anxiety. They may also feel reduced self-confidence, a decreased desire to socialize with others, and difficulties with productivity at school or work. Prevent Blindness offers TED patients and others the Vision Loss and Mental Wellness resource from its Living Well with Low Vision program. The dedicated web page offers tips to support mental health and links to mental health organizations. To help educate patients, care partners, and healthcare professionals, Prevent Blindness provides a variety of free TED educational resources, including comprehensive fact sheets and social media graphics, available in English and Spanish, and a dedicated web page. As part of its Focus on Eye Health Expert series, Prevent Blindness also offers episodes, Thyroid Eye Disease and the TED Community, featuring Christine Gustafson, Executive Director and CEO of the TED Community Organization and Prevent Blindness Aspect Program graduate, discussing her TED journey, her work to establish her nonprofit group, and the resources it provides. Thyroid Eye Disease, TED, and Mental Wellness, featuring neuro-ophthalmic conditions expert Prem Subramania, MD, PhD, Clifford R. and Janice N. Merrill Endowed Chair in Ophthalmology and Vice Chair for Academic Affairs at Sue Anschutz Rogers Eye Center, UC Health, discusses TED, its potential impact on mental health, and the importance of patient and healthcare provider communication to help improve health outcomes. Thyroid Eye Disease, TED, with Sarah Wester, MD, FACS, Professor of Clinical Ophthalmology at Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, and TED patient Stephen Bander. We are in an exciting time of offering hope and help to those with thyroid eye disease and their care partners, thanks to access to new treatment options and the development of new medications on the horizon, said Jeff Todd, Prevent Blindness President and CEO. Because TED often impacts vision and mental health, our goal is to provide the public, patients, and care partners with information needed to understand and mitigate the effects of TED and help patients enjoy a high quality of life for years to come. For more information on TED, please visit https://preventblindness.org/thyroid-eye-disease. For more information on low vision and resources, visit Living Well with Low Vision, https://lowvision.preventblindness.org. Next up, we have a piece from the National Conference of State Legislatures. This is entitled Workforce Shortages and Disability. Labor Gaps as Opportunities: How Workforce Shortages Can Impact Employment for People with Disabilities. The pandemic accelerated technological advances and demographic shifts in society, significantly impacting the employment landscape. Changes in the style and structure of work, including remote work, combined with the renewed worker focus on personal priorities, have created challenges and opportunities for many industries seeking to fill open positions. The resulting labor shortages present opportunities for people with disabilities seeking employment. Both public sector and state-based private sector incentives for employers who want to hire workers with disabilities can increase employment opportunities for disabled individuals. Workers with disabilities can fill public sector job vacancies. State government is one of many sectors struggling with labor shortages. To address this issue, state and local policymakers have pursued creative strategies to recruit, promote, hire, and retain state government employees, including those from historically underemployed groups. One approach seeks to increase the participation of people with disabilities in the labor force, often through the adoption of state as a model employer policies. SAME policies are formal initiatives by state governments to promote inclusive employment practices for disabled people. For example, New York passed legislation mandating state agency website accessibility and allowing employees with disabilities to work part-time in certain state jobs. California mandated that state agencies develop reasonable accommodation policies for workers. Massachusetts operates a reasonable accommodation capital reserve account designed to supplement existing agency resources. The Council of State Governments, in collaboration with the State Exchange on Employment and Disability, provides resources on SAME policies enacted across states. State governments have also reduced barriers for people with disabilities and other historically underrepresented groups by streamlining hiring processes. One strategy involves shifting to skills-based hiring, which assesses a candidate's relevant experience and expertise rather than their level of education. As of October 2024, at least a dozen states have removed degree requirements from state employment, and others have taken similar steps. For example, in 2022, Colorado Governor Jared Polis issued an executive order mandating the state to evaluate whether degree requirements can be removed from positions. In 2023, in an effort to increase the number of applicants for state positions, Arizona enacted legislation mandating reviews of all state roles to determine whether four-year degree requirements could be removed. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin also recently removed degree requirements for most state jobs. Implementing hiring preferences for historically underrepresented groups in the public sector is another strategy. For example, Virginia in 2022 and West Virginia in 2023 mandated state hiring preferences for underrepresented groups such as veterans and people with disabilities. Historically, the apprenticeship model has been associated with trades, but policymakers are increasingly using this strategy to fill public sector roles, or at least make them more accessible to people without formal education. In 2023, Idaho enacted legislation to remove funding barriers for state agencies hiring apprentices. Virginia enacted legislation in 2022, directing the Board of Workforce Development to draft recommendations to create an office dedicated to apprenticeships. Washington created a committee of state agency human resources managers to develop public sector apprenticeships programs. Ohio's Vocational Apprentice Program provides apprenticeship opportunities for people with disabilities. This broadening of the apprenticeship model can help historically underrepresented workers, including those with disabilities, access a career in the public sector. Incentives and support can benefit both employers and workers in the private sector. The private sector has also addressed workforce shortages by embracing talent pools historically underrepresented in the labor force. Several states have enacted legislation in recent years incentivizing employers to hire people with disabilities, including creating and/or increasing tax credits for businesses that do so. Maryland increased the wages eligible for the credit from the first $9,000 earned to the first $15,000 earned. In 2023, North Dakota increased the tax credit offered to employers from 5% to 25% of $6,000 in wages for hiring a person with a developmental disability or severe mental illness. In addition, states are recognizing that disability etiquette training can create a welcoming and supportive work environment for people with disabilities. For example, all Massachusetts state employees must complete a disability awareness training within 1 year of employment, and Illinois requires all state agencies to send a hiring manager annually to training on hiring people with disabilities. Some states are creating additional supports for smaller employers. Many small businesses are open to hiring workers with disabilities, but are daunted by the potential cost of providing reasonable accommodations. While a federal tax credit does exist to help offset these costs, states can provide additional funding to incentivize the hiring of people with disabilities. Last year, Minnesota created through legislation the Employer Reasonable Accommodation Fund to reimburse small to mid-size employers for costs they incur to provide reasonable accommodations. States can also educate employers on the cost and a range of possible reasonable accommodations, since many are low cost or free, with the Office of Disability Employment Policy's Job Accommodation Network reporting that many have a one-time cost as low as $300. And now an article from Ophthalmology Times. The title, Help Me See, Teaming Up with Empowered with Meg Ryan to Highlight Solutions for Global Cataract Blindness Crisis in New Episode, by David Hutton. Key takeaways. Cataract blindness affects over 100 million people globally, creating a significant socioeconomic burden, especially in low-income populations lacking surgical care access. Help Me See's simulation-based training equips healthcare providers to perform manual small incision cataract surgery, expanding access to underserved areas. Cataract blindness disproportionately impacts women, often confining them to the home and affecting their socioeconomic contributions. The collaboration aims to inspire action and innovation, promoting equitable access to quality eye care and reducing preventable blindness worldwide. Help Me See recently collaborated with Empowered, an educational television series hosted by actress Meg Ryan, on a new episode addressing the public health crisis of cataract blindness, a leading cause of preventable blindness worldwide. Filmed in September 2024, this episode highlights the socioeconomic and medical challenges surrounding cataract blindness and introduces viewers to new advancements in surgical training technology that empower healthcare professionals to deliver surgical solutions to underserved communities. The program is distributed via a third party to public television stations in all 50 states. Preventable cataract-related visual impairment and blindness affects over 100 people worldwide, creating a significant socioeconomic burden, as low-income populations often lack access to necessary surgical care. Help Me See is leading the way with realistic simulation-based training that equips surgeons and healthcare workers to safely and effectively perform manual small incision cataract surgery, helping to expand access to transformative cataract surgery for those in greatest need. According to Bonnie Ann Henderson, MD, President and CEO of Help Me See, the need for cataract surgical treatment is urgent. Vision loss due to cataract is far more than a medical issue. It is a socioeconomic crisis that disproportionately affects women, Dr. Henderson noted. Often, the family member suffering from cataract is confined to the home, which frequently forces the youngest female in the family to give up work or education to provide care. The episode highlights the following: socioeconomic impact of cataract blindness, an exploration of how cataract blindness disproportionately affects low-income populations and women, limiting their ability to work and contribute to their communities. Advancements in simulation-based surgical training. A close look at how innovative Help Me See simulation-based training technology is training healthcare providers, making it possible to deliver high-quality surgical care to previously underserved areas. Promoting equitable access to healthcare. Insight into how accessible and affordable eye care can help alleviate global blindness rates and contribute to socioeconomic development. Through this collaboration, Empowered and Help Me See seek to inspire action and innovation, encouraging viewers to support solutions that make quality eye care more equitable and reduce preventable blindness worldwide. The episode will be distributed once completed and will be available nationwide. Ryan is known for her roles as quirky, charismatic characters in such films as When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle, Top Gun, The Doors, Courage Under Fire, and many others. She earned a Golden Globe nomination for her role in When Harry Met Sally. After a break from films, she returned to the big screen in 2023 in the romantic comedy What Happens Later, which she also directed. Here's a reminder that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now from Access Wire, Dow's disability hiring and employment practices recognized by the National Organization on Disability, Midland, Michigan. Dow, New York Stock Exchange, DOW, was recently honored with a Leading Disability Employer seal by the National Organization on Disability, NOD, marking the eighth consecutive year Dow has received this recognition. This recognition spotlights the transformative contributions made by business leaders in promoting employment opportunities for individuals with disabilities. It also honors those organizations that prioritize diversity, equity, and importantly, accessibility, setting a high standard for others to follow. The Leading Disability Employer seal is granted based on the NOD Employment Tracker, a comprehensive assessment tool that evaluates key business practices related to hiring, retention, and advancement of people with disabilities. Scoring prioritized practices that are associated with increased disability employment outcomes over time, and companies received additional points based on the percentage of people with disabilities in their workforce. Dow scored highly when considering disability employment strategy, practices, and performance. It is an honor to receive this recognition for an eighth consecutive year, said John Sampson, executive sponsor for Dow's Disability Employee Network and Senior Vice President of Operations, Manufacturing, and Engineering. We are proud to be named a leading disability employer and are committed to fostering a workplace of inclusion, equitable opportunity, and accessibility. In addition to Dow's HR policies and talent acquisition programs, the DEN Employee Resource Group aims to empower employees with disabilities and to raise awareness and educate about disabilities to create better allies. We are incredibly grateful to Dow for their commitment to disability inclusion, said Beth Searle, Chief Executive Officer and President, National Organization on Disability. We believe that diversity fuels innovation and growth, and Dow embodies this vision in action. We applaud their efforts and investments to provide pathways to fulfilling careers for Americans with disabilities. Visit Dow's website for additional information on the company's commitments to inclusion and diversity, and to explore the company's 2023 Intersections Progress Report. In contrast to that piece about Dow, here's a piece from Fortune about Amazon entitled Amazon Makes It Harder for Disabled Employees to Work From Home by Spencer Soper. Amazon.com Inc. is making it harder for disabled employees to get permission to work from home, underscoring the tech giant's determination to get its corporate workforce back to the office 5 days a week. The company recently told employees with disabilities that it was implementing a more rigorous vetting process, both for new requests to work from home and applications to extend existing arrangements. Affected workers must submit to a multi-level leader review and could be required to return to the office for month-long trials to determine if accommodations meet their needs. The revised disability policy, which hasn't previously been reported, is roiling a workforce already alienated by a 5-day return to office mandate that's scheduled to begin in January. Chief Executive Officer Andy Jassy says the return to office requirement will strengthen the company's culture, which he believes has suffered since the pandemic and become overly bureaucratic. But the policy made Amazon a tech industry outlier and is seen by some employees as a way to get people to quit and shrink the workforce. Amazon has denied having an ulterior motive and says the new disability policy reflects its broader return to office philosophy. We understand that this is going to be a transition, and we're working with our employees to make it as easy as possible, Amazon spokesperson Margaret Callahan said in a statement. We continue to believe that the advantages of being together in the office are significant. When in-person accommodations are needed, we'll provide them, and, in some cases, offer an exception to working from the office. She declined to say how many requests have been approved. The Americans with Disabilities Act requires employers to make reasonable accommodations, including service animals, reserved parking spaces, and closed captioned meetings to help disabled employees do their jobs. But there are no hard and fast rules guaranteeing such workers the right to work remotely, giving Amazon leverage to call them back to offices even if they've been working successfully from home. Affected employees are receiving calls from accommodation consultants who explain how the new policy works. They review medical documentation and discuss how effective working from home has been for employees who've already received an accommodation, as well as any previous attempts to help the person work in the office. If the consultant agrees that the person should be allowed to work from home, another Amazon manager must sign off. If they don't, the request goes to a third manager. During a conversation with an employee suffering from a stress disorder, according to a person familiar with the exchange, an accommodation consultant attempted to establish rapport, but also asked the person about sensitive medical issues, such as how the person navigates life outside work and how long it takes them to regulate emotions during a panic attack. Spokesperson Callahan said, finding effective work accommodations might entail asking employees questions to understand how they navigate their disabilities outside work. One employee, who requested anonymity because they feared retaliation from Amazon, said the process is so convoluted that weeks have passed since applying for a disability exception. The employee's doctor wrote a letter detailing why the worker should be allowed to work from home, and the disability team requested further documentation. The worker described answering a question only to be asked it again by someone else. Callahan said if a case is complex, it may require clarification questions and take more time to finalize than others. Some workers fear the process was designed to make requests less likely to be improved, two employees said. In internal chat rooms, according to one of them, employees have accused Jassy of hypocrisy because the bureaucratic process belies his stated determination to cut through red tape that he says is slowing Amazon down. In 2023, after the rise of remote work, 22.5% of people with disabilities were employed, the highest percentage since the Bureau of Labor Statistics began tracking the metric in 2008. Working from home can benefit people with a range of disabilities, including chronic allergies, limited mobility, and anxiety disorders. Some advocates for the disabled fret that Amazon's position as the country's second largest private employer could influence other companies and erode pandemic-era gains for disabled workers. It sets a dangerous precedent with other employers, says Ariel Sims, president and CEO of Disability Belongs, an advocacy group. Some employees just leave their jobs if the accommodation process is too difficult to navigate. Workers denied permission to work remotely can file discrimination complaints with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a federal agency that investigates discrimination claims in the workplace. That would put the burden on Amazon to prove that being in the office is an essential part of a job, said Kenneth Shiantani, a senior staff attorney at the National Disability Rights Network? That's the big gray area. How essential is the in-person aspect of the job? Shiantani said. There are clearly jobs where being there in person is an essential function. It is much harder to prove in an office, white-collar job, since electronic communication is pretty effective. And now a piece from Chalkbeat. Trump plan to axe the Education Department might affect kids with disabilities a lot or a little, by Kaylin Belsha. A federal hearing about special education teacher shortages turned into a debate about how the potential elimination of the U.S. Department of Education would affect students with disabilities. The exchange, which occurred Friday during a public briefing of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, speaks to how Donald Trump's election is already shaping education policy discussions amid widespread uncertainty about how his proposals could play out. Trump vowed on the campaign trail that he would dismantle the federal education department and hand more control over education to the states. The federal law that guarantees students with disabilities a right to a free and appropriate public education dates back to 1975, before the Education Department existed as a standalone entity. The law would remain on the books even if the department were disbanded, but it's less clear how funding would change or who would be responsible for protecting students' rights. Eliminating a federal department would require an act of Congress. Trump has not spelled out exactly how special education funding or administration would change if that happens, but some have made suggestions. Project 2025, a political playbook written by former Trump White House officials, for example, calls for turning most federal funding for special education into no-strings grants for school districts distributed by another agency altogether, the Department of Health and Human Services. Trump has tapped Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a vaccine skeptic with no education experience, to lead that agency. Project 2025 also calls for moving the Office of Civil Rights and any assets in the Federal Special Education Office that work on discrimination to the Department of Justice. There, civil rights enforcement would be done through lawsuits, not investigations, as they're done now in the Education Department. At the briefing, Commissioner Mondaire Jones, a Democrat and former congressman, asked a panel of experts whether eliminating the Education Department would have an effect on students with disabilities and the shortage of educators to teach them. Several panelists said the federal government still needs to fund education, even if the Education Department no longer exists. Eric Heneshek, a prominent education researcher of school funding and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, said he thought the proposal was more of a political statement about how much we want Washington to be intruding in state education policy and that it wouldn't actually change much for students with disabilities. It would still be Congress's job to decide how much to spend on fulfilling the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, Heneshek said, even if funding were dispersed through another agency like a revamped Health and Human Services Department. I don't think it has any obvious impact on IDEA funding, Heneshek said. I personally think that the federal government should have a larger responsibility in special education funding. But he cautioned that students with disabilities could get less immediate attention without an education secretary calling attention to their needs from the bully pulpit. Eliminating the department and moving its work elsewhere could also jeopardize data collection and research about students with disabilities, Heneshek said. William Trackman, the general counsel at the Mountain States Legal Foundation, a conservative law firm that's suing the Biden administration over its Title IX rules, said the answer would depend on what replaces the Education Department. It is not going to happen that there is no federal role in special education whatsoever, he said. Whether the Department of Justice takes over civil rights enforcement, whether special education moves to HHS, or whether states get block grants to use for special education, a lot of the impact of what happens is going to be revealed through those details. Others said eliminating the Education Department would have serious consequences for students with disabilities. Tuan Nguyen, an associate professor at the University of Missouri who studies teacher labor markets, said he worried that without a federal Education Department putting pressure on states to require certain standards for teaching, who ends up working with students with disabilities would be a free-for-all. Years of evidence have shown that when states don't have a mandate to make sure that our teachers are licensed and qualified, they'll put anybody they can in the classroom, Nguyen said. Amanda Levine Mazin, a senior lecturer at Columbia University's Teachers College, said she worried that without an education department, there would be cuts to incentives that help people enter the special education teaching profession. The Education Department has the discretion to award a variety of grants to school districts, universities, and others to support teacher recruitment and pipeline development. Jessica Levine, the litigation director of the Education Law Center, a nonprofit that advocates on behalf of students with disabilities, said she worried that eliminating the department would hurt the enforcement of students' civil rights. Historically, most federal civil rights complaints in education are related to a student's disability. The Department of Education and the experts within it play a crucial role in enforcing those civil rights for students with disabilities across the country, she said. This is an incredibly dangerous proposal, both on a practical and symbolic level. Next up is a piece from Forbes entitled, "New Film Daruma Wants to Show Disability Isn't Synonymous with Despair," by Stephen Aquino. I can't recall exactly when I first connected with Kelly McNeil Yellen. All I know is she found me on Instagram literal years ago and told me about this movie she was making that centers the disability community representationally. That film, called Daruma, opens this Friday. It will be showing in brick-and-mortar theaters, as well as available to rent or buy on Amazon and what once was iTunes, but now is the TV app. On its website, Daruma is lauded as the first film in U.S. cinematic history to star two authentically cast disabled leads in a narrative not about overcoming disability, and executive produced by Peter Farley. The film is about an unemployed, paraplegic man who learns he has a 4-year-old daughter and his amputee friend who embark on a cross-country trip to take the girl to her grandparents. Daruma has the support of numerous high-profile disability organizations such as the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, Easter Seals, and many more. In a telephone interview conducted earlier this week, Yellen explained the impetus for Daruma lies in the experiences of a family member who had a spinal cord injury. The movie's storyline is fully fictional, but Yellen said she was struck in the early 2000s at how all of the narratives in media depicted the idea that dying was better than living with a disability, which she defined as heartbreaking. She thought Hollywood types and society writ large could do much better, especially since having a disability absolutely does not mean life is over. Moreover, Yellen noticed how inaccessible films could be to disabled people. She made it her personal mission to make a film that was accessible and told a story where it authentically cast disabled leads, but it's not about overcoming disability. Yellen shopped her pitch to people but found no takers. Everyone wanted to cast it their way, but Yellen said her line in the sand was she refused to negotiate the notion of authentically casting the lead actors for the project. It sat in a drawer for years, she said. It wasn't until when Yellen started dating her now husband, director and cinematographer Alexander Yellen, that what would become Daruma would truly begin to take shape. In an interview concurrent to his wife's, Alex told me he read Kelly's script and was impressed, telling her it would make a good independent film. This was in 2017, with the next year featuring what's called in the industry as a proof of concept. That was essentially the trailer for Daruma, with Kelly saying it was a monumental step on a 17-year journey rife with ardor and adversity. To make the film, we had to call in every single favor we'd ever banged in a 20-year career in the business, Kelly said of making Daruma. We were given Panavision's New Filmmakers Grant, which is an incredible camera package, so the film looks incredibly cinematic. We've been shuffling it through distribution and getting it out into the world. When asked about the current state of disability representation in film and television, Alex conceded he didn't have a relationship to disability prior to getting together with Kelly. He said his only exposure to it was watching Marley Matlin's character, Joey Lucas, on The West Wing. Alex further noted he doesn't see much genuine disability representation in media, saying there's some, but not nearly enough. He praised shows like Echo on Disney Plus as making inroads in this realm, but reiterated his own experience has been that disability has not been something that's been in the mainstream for most of my life. Meeting and working with the disabled actors in Daruma, he has directorial credit, was an eye-opening and incredibly gratifying experience for Alex. The actors, John W. Lawson and Tobias Forrest, are incredibly talented, and Alex is honored to be part of their journey as creative people in Hollywood. Kelly concurred with Alex, telling me she's concerned that the progress that's been made gets taken away at some point. The representational angle is so important, she told me, adding, it's incumbent upon us to lean into this as much as we can now and to show the world that Daruma is a beautiful film. The disability community is chock full of talented people, Kelly said, and earnest representation in pieces like her film is vital. Kelly said the overarching message of Daruma is simple. Disability is part of everyday life, and disabled people are everyday people. It isn't something to be sullied or pitied, certainly not a fate worse than death. Disability is part and parcel of the human condition for a quarter of the population. To say otherwise is dehumanizing. Alex pushed harder on the normalcy theme. The thing that's almost subversive about Daruma is it's a very normal film, he said. This is not a story that's reinventing any wheels. It's a road trip movie. It's a fun, family road trip movie. Everybody has seen movies like this before. Disabled people aren't extraordinary in overcoming, Alex added. Everybody has to relate to family members. Everybody has to navigate emotional challenges, he said. If we can tell a story that everybody can connect with, then it doesn't matter we're telling it with two guys who have disabilities. You could have told this exact same story with two men from any background, and it would have had the same effect. By telling a story anybody can relate to, we're showing them people with disabilities have the same fundamental experiences as they do. By the end of the movie, the audience forgets these guys even have disabilities. Farley's involvement with Daruma is a big deal. What with him being an Oscar winner and producing and directing such movies as Dumb and Dumber, and There's Something About Mary. His weight carries heavily, giving Kelly and Alex's work a certain cachet. It runs deeper than credentials or name recognition, though, as Alex told me. Farley has long been a disability advocate. Farley's friend suffered a spinal cord injury while they were in college, with Alex telling me Farley has included disabled people in the vast majority of his films. As to Daruma, Alex said Farley was thrilled to sign on as executive producer and help open some doors with studios and streamers to help get the movie out in the world. It had a profound impact on both Kelly and Alex. Alex said it's meaningful when someone of Farley's caliber compliments the work they've been doing. Alex noted Farley has said he'd be proud to be associated with Daruma and, as such, has consistently been a wonderful supporter throughout the entire process. When asked about feedback, both Kelly and Alex said Daruma has traveled the festival circuit until now, with Alex saying the response has been tremendous, particularly among disabled moviegoers. Audiences have praised the dimensionality of the protagonists, noting how it reflects what Alex described as the breadth and depth of the humanity that exists within the disability community. Able-bodied viewers, he added, have been pleasantly surprised at how good Daruma is as a piece of art. I think we've opened some eyes along the way, Alex said of the early reception. You never know until you put it out in front of the mass audience writ large, but if our festival experience is any indication, I think people are going to really like the movie. Kelly said the reviews have been encouraging. One in particular, by Liz Whitmore at Real News Daily, said in part, "If you aren't welling up by the film's ending, check your pulse," adding, "Representation is vital to authentic storytelling, and the world needs more films like Daruma." As to the future, Kelly said she has other projects in mind. For Daruma, both she and Alex hope people see the film in theaters or via streaming. The couple's main hope is to get mainstream audiences to see there's a market for representational content, with Kelly saying Daruma was made completely outside the studio system. They want people to show up and really show people there's an appetite for this kind of content. Well, that's it for our program. Thanks for joining us for the Disability News Program. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. And please keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.